Fred Film Radio, this is Antonio back from the Biogra Film Festival in Bologna, Italy, and I'm here with Robert Gordon, who just presented his film here, Best of Enemies. Welcome, Robert. So, we used to have intellectuals chiming in Europe, much like Gore and Vidal did, as depicted in your film. So what about the US? How do things work over there?
So we used to have intellectuals, yeah, also, and now we don't. And what we do have is mouthpieces. We have people who, you know, take a piece of paper from someone above them that has talking points, and they come on the news and they say what they're told to say. And so so we don't have them in the media, and we don't really have them in politics so much anymore. You know, there are exceptions, but politicians seem more inclined to satisfy their party than to satisfy their own personal beliefs. I think it's interesting that there was John Kennedy, the president, former president, when he was in college, wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. And it was about politicians who had gone against, who had stood up to their own beliefs. And, you know, he could fill a book with that. It'd be hard to do that now in America. You know, I just don't. And I think it, in a way, it's part of the commodification of everything. People want to turn their careers into money and not into intellectual legacy. And the last part of the answer is that finally the media doesn't allow a place for this anymore. Among the most remarkable things about the Buckley and Vidal meetings, looking back now, is that those guys were given 15 minutes uninterrupted on primetime TV. And now no one gets 15 minutes. You know, the most you get is 8 minutes or 9 minutes. And it's often very interrupted. You know, you'll have an 8-minute broadcast that's got three different segments in it. So this was a time when people could develop ideas and could really, you know, an audience could watch this interaction and feel, there was enough time to feel the passion and feel the heat. I mean, now it's just a show. It's like a wrestling match, you know, and not a sport wrestling match, but a theatrical.
Now, this being an old incident, were you ever worried that the film would appeal only to an older audience?
There was, from the time we first got interested in making the film until we were funded to actually make the film, was 4 years. And in that time, we began to shoot interviews and do some of the work, but we never could get into high gear. So one of the things I learned in those 4 years was how few people under 35 knew who either man was. I'm 54. In 1968, I was 7. But that means that when I was a kid coming up, I would watch Buckley on TV. I couldn't understand a word he said. He was fun to watch. You know, he'd lay back like this and smoke. And it was really cool. It was, you know, better than the preacher. When he was on in my hometown, it was preacher, Buckley. So I watched Buckley. And Vidal was in every library. You know, he wrote thick books, and you would see in all these libraries these spines that had, you know, in everyone's house, spines with all of the same, you know, same font titles of Vidal. So I thought everybody knew them, and it was a real shock to me to realize how diminished their reputations had become. So that began to change the nature of the show, because we realized how much biography we'd have to include in the telling. But I think it made it for a better show. You know, it's a more powerful show if you understand the people speaking more so than if you just hear their ideas. I was attracted by their ideas, but I enjoyed being able to expand it into a larger context.
The music helped make the film so funny and hilarious. Was it always your plan to use classical music and have this soundtrack?
I'm going to answer that in a minute, but at the first screening of the finished film, it was at Sundance, 500 people. Prior to that, we'd never shown it to more than like 5 people at a time, you know, and really not a lot, and never the finished film. So we were really worried, you know, whether people would feel comfortable laughing, because it's such a serious, the thing we had to fight, it is this idea that, oh, it's going to be a very boring film about 2 boring people who are talking heads, you know, and so we had to figure out how to make it cinematic, and these guys are so sharp and witty that we knew it was going to be funny. So so when we screened it at Sundance, the first, you know, 30 minutes, it was like we were sitting in a Steve Martin comedy or a Roberto Benigni comedy, you know. It was like, wow, this is great. We were just really, really triumphant. And then the music, we knew from the beginning, that we wanted to use classical music, rely largely on classical music, because it fits the nature of the two men. And we began to collect pieces. I would hear, you know, I got Shazam on my phone, and I would hear, I was particularly listening for pieces that sounded like they might, that like dance pieces, balletic music or waltzes, because it seemed like this was kind of a verbal waltz, or a verbal tango maybe. And then, so we temped it with all classical music and then hired a cellist to write some original score, you know, and Morgan and I, my partner and I, have made a number of music documentaries prior to this, so we have a feel for music, and it just all came together really beautifully.
Would you say that the footage used is pretty contemporary?
No. Yes, it was very much in our mind that that this should relate, that people should see it and be aware that it's today. When I saw that raw footage, the raw debates the first time, it was just so shockingly contemporary. So we struggled. Maybe the hardest part in the making of the film was figuring out when to come in and sit and make this contemporary comparison. We, for a long time, thought it was going to be at the beginning. If we just dropped this notion at the beginning for people to think about, that it would be there, but there was no place for it, you know, and it kept getting pushed back and back and back until we realized, ah, if we can make the viewer have this realization during the course of the film, and we only at the end affirm it, then they feel like, you know, then it works on a lot of levels. It makes the viewer feel very satisfied, and it doesn't bog down the film by having to come back and hit this point over and over. So yeah, that was important to make that contemporary statement, but hard to figure out where to make it.
So Robert, do you think there are any viable intellectuals out there?
I'm sure they're out there. And one of the effects that I hope the film has is that some TV network somewhere will be desperate enough, like ABC in 1968, and they will say, well, let's give the smart people a chance to come back on TV and say something, you know, and maybe, you know, then the trend would come back. That'd be great. You know, and like I told the TV guy, when Christopher Hitchens died, I think that he, in a way, was the last a big. It was the end of a big era, and because I love that he was able to change his ideas publicly in the course of his career. And I think that's very brave. And because he was able to see both sides of things so sharply, I thought the great debate would be Christopher Hitchens interviewing Christopher Hitchens. And I will say that the Buckley biographer in the film, Sam Tannenhaus, kind of red-haired guy, was so compelling and spoke so well that I'm like nominating him. I want Sam to like give up his career and to go on to be a TV commentator.
Do you watch any television at all?
Not much. I really don't watch much. In my house, I'm number four on who gets the remote. Yeah, my wife, my older kid, my younger kid than me. So, I've been toying. Most of the TV I've watched in the past few years has been TV series, limited run TV series. I've been dabbling in that genre, and so kind of interested to see what other people are doing. And I'll occasionally watch in America on Sunday mornings. There's political roundtables. You know, and I tune in occasionally. Mostly I get angry watching. I get my news from the radio. I listen to talk shows on the radio. So that's sort of more my...
It's really interesting how things have changed over time, because these intellectuals were really close to political parties back then, but still they could have their own opinions which differed from the parties. So could you delve a little bit more into this?
If when John Kerry ran against George Bush, you had John Kerry, who, you know, had been abroad, spoke French fluently, you know, was a well-rounded intellectual man. And you had George Bush, who was not. And one of the ways the media sold Bush is this notion of, you know, who would you like to have a beer with? And, you know, I don't know where it became important to think that I want the man to run this country. You know, I want Joe the Plumber. They used to trot him out. You know, I want Joe the Plumber to run the country. It's like, no, I want Joe the Plumber to be heard. You know, I want the people in the bar to be heard. But the man who's running the country, I want to be a big thinker. So, and Obama is interesting in that way, in that he's a very bright man. You know, I think a little politically naive, which was kind of good in the beginning, and I'm not so sure how good it is now. And as I look ahead to the political scene in America, it's like, you know, it's kind of weird. But I think we're going to have a Bush-Clinton election again. And then it's, you know, flashbacks. Terrible, terrible flashbacks.
Story attempt to repeat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hillary, you know, I mean, I think she's kind of keen. She's sharp. She carries, and I think she would actually be a good president. And I think Jeb Bush has been ruined by George Bush, George W. Bush, his brother.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, if they'd flipped it, it would have been better. Jeb was the smarter one, a little sharper, could see things, but I think we've had it, you know, I think the country's kind of done with that. But who knows what they'll say when they get up and figure out who they want to have a beer with.
And it's also interesting that television was used to cement opinions in the past. It wasn't used to shatter opinions like they do now.
In the days of Walter Cronkite, which is the old days when you had like, he was this very, when there was three networks, he was this very famous newscaster. And the good thing was that everybody got the same news. And then everybody could respond to that news. But the bad thing was that that news that everybody got was determined by, you know, an elite group of white men high in a tower in New York. And so it was a double-edged sword. You know, the web has allowed us, and Twitter, you know, has allowed us to hear from the people in the streets real observation about what's going on. You know, I don't think news... We've had a lot of incidents in America where people with a cell phone have photographed or videoed policemen doing terrible things, right? And so that has opened America's eyes, that the police need reform. But the news, Walter Cronkite would never have dared go there. It would have unraveled and undermined society. So it's a, so that is a double-edged sword, that that golden years of the newscaster. But I think the problem today is even worse, because the problem with the web is that it's twofold. One, there's no authority. I can go on the internet and say, I was just in Bologna and it was freezing cold, right? And then somebody will say, you know, this source was in Bologna and it was freezing cold. And it goes out and no one, I don't have the authority, I don't even have to, I could say it about Rome. I'm not going to Rome, you know, and no one's checking me. No one's checking the sources. And the result is, we live in a time when there's no longer facts, and that's just as scary as it can be, right? If we don't know, if we are reading, if you know, a candidate or a president is out doing something, and Fox says black and MSNBC says white, you know, they can't both be true, and yet both of their audiences think they're true. In the early part of the 20th century, Bernard Baruch, consultant to one of the presidents, said, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but we all have to share the facts. And we live in a world where that's not true anymore, and it's, I think, a horrible undermine. I think that people are... I think then we go from Bernard Baruch to P.T. Barnum, who says there's a sucker born every minute. You know, that I think people believe what they want to believe. That's why Fox is popular. You know, in my opinion, Fox is a much more biased program than MSNBC. MSNBC leans, but Fox, you know, is way, way leaning. So I think that audience is eating that up just as fast as they can, because it's what they want to believe. It makes them angry. When they're angry, they feel good. It's like, argh, you know, we've got to fight for this. And they don't question the realities. So the manipulation has grown significantly, and the awareness has not.
Is this why you said that the film is a cautionary tale?
Somewhere between an absurdist comedy and a cautionary tale, right? So the cautionary tale is, look at the change this has wrought. You know, because the ratings went up when they yelled, now all we have is the yelling. There's not the thought. There's not the examination. There's not the authority. There's not the history. And our hope would be to bring some of those things back. So many times, you know, it's desperation that causes the change. The first first African-American radio station in America began in Memphis, my hometown, and it was there because the new radio station went on the air and was failing. They couldn't win over any of the existing audience. And before they lost their investment, they said, let's take a chance, you know. And it changed, and it became like the number two station in the city, and it set a trend. I think it's the same with ABC, you know, out of desperation. They couldn't afford to do what everyone else was doing, and they said, let's try this thing, and lo and behold, all of a sudden, you know, there's a headline in the show, I think it says, CBS, in 1972, CBS will emulate, you know, will follow the example of ABC, and so ABC goes from behind to ahead.
Thank you, Robert Gordon, for taking the time. This is Antonio back from the Biograph Film Festival in Bologna, Italy, for Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.